Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Thanks for joining me for another installment of New Books in Military History. With me today is Ben Shepherd. He's a reader at Glasgow Caledonian University in the UK. And we're here today to talk about his recent book, Terror in the Balkans, German Armies and Partisan Warfare, which was published this year by Harvard University Press. Thanks for joining me, Ben.
Thanks. Thanks, Jay.
I like to start the interviews by allowing the authors to kind of introduce themselves, give us a little bit of a sense of how you came to the project.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been interested in World War II from the age of five, which was some cause for concern for my parents when I was that age. But in terms of the development of the ideas which have led to this book, I suppose the genesis of them lies in my undergraduate final year project, which I did on the German officer corps in the Second World War. I was particularly interested not in their, or not so much in their military performance, as in questions like their relationship with the Nazi regime, their role in occupation policy, whether it was to do with their role in the treatment of prisoners of war, ordinary civilians, partisans, stroke guerrillas, minority groups such as Roma and Sinti, communists, and of course Jews. Obviously, these issues are much more vital and still much more emotive when it comes to Eastern Europe than it does to Western Europe. And so therefore, the PhD research, which was a direct development from my undergraduate project, dealt with German army anti-partisan units behind the lines in the Soviet Union. And with the current book, I've sought to investigate German army anti-partisan units in occupied Yugoslavia during World War II. So it's all about investigating the role of the German army at the level of not the top generals and not the ordinary soldiers either, but the units in the middle, divisions, regiments, and so on, and how they were conducting themselves towards partisans, Jews, communists, civilians generally, how things like Nazi ideology and the conditions which they faced on the ground shaped their behavior towards these groups, whether in a brutal direction or in a more moderating direction in some cases.
Right. Well, the first book made quite a splash, and in part because the area is so understudied in many ways. Certainly in English, there's not very much written about anti-partisan warfare, and yet it was a huge part of the German war effort, and obviously a huge part of the atrocities that the German army committed.
Yeah.
So you began to investigate Yugoslavia. One of the strengths of the book, I think, is your ability to kind of clarify the ethnic tangle and the kind of political ethnic situation that the Germans find when they invade the country in 1941. Mm-hmm. So maybe it might help our listeners to understand a little bit about who some of the cast of characters are that you're studying.
Certainly. The Germans hadn't expected to have to invade or occupy Yugoslavia in the first place. They invaded the country in April 1941, but that was under very unexpected circumstances. But to cut a very long story short, they invaded Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia was supposed to be joining the tripartite pact with Germany and Italy. And at the last minute, there was a coup in Yugoslavia. And whilst the new Yugoslav government continued to pledge support for the tripartite pact, Hitler didn't trust them anymore. And so he invaded Yugoslavia with the aid of the Italians as a means of securing the Balkan flank in the run-up to the invasion of the Soviet Union, which took place 2 months later. So the Germans and their Axis allies, the Italians, the Bulgarians, and so on, found themselves in a situation where they were occupying a country which they hadn't expected to occupy, and Hitler in particular wanted to occupy the country on a shoestring. So the various parts of Yugoslavia were carved up. Some were occupied directly by Germany, some went to Germany's Axis satellites and to Italy. Others still were placed under puppet governments, particularly the independent state of Croatia, which fell under the charge of the fascist Ustasha movement. And because the Germans didn't want to commit a great deal in the way of resources to occupying Yugoslavia, it was much harder for them to keep a lid on the ethnic tensions which already existed and which the Axis occupation exacerbated. And the three main groupings, or the three main, should we say, ethnically based groupings in occupied Yugoslavia were the Ustasha in the independent state of Croatia. Then you had the Chetnik movement, which was based not just in Serbia, but also in the Serb-populated regions elsewhere in Yugoslavia, including those in the independent state of Croatia. And then also within the independent state of Croatia, particularly in Bosnia, you had the Bosnian Muslims. And they're less pivotally important to the story that I'm telling than were the Chetniks or the Ustasha, but they certainly figure. And that's not to mention, of course, the partisan movement, which was a multi-ethnic movement within Yugoslavia. So four major players there, all of whom had their causes of grievance with one another, whether these grievances were to do with long-standing ethnic rivalries, whether they were to do with political and economic, or whether they were a result, rather, of political and economic problems that had beset Yugoslavia during the interwar years. There was a whole hotbed of tensions between these different groups, and the fact that the Germans weren't occupying Yugoslavia with anything like the amount of troops on the ground that they would have needed to really keep a lid on those tensions, and the fact that their Axis allies, such as the Italians, weren't in a position to effectively keep a lid on those tensions either, meant that those tensions were going to increasingly boil over and cause increasing chaos and difficulty, not just for the smooth running of the Axis occupation, but also in much more deadly ways for the Yugoslav population on the ground caught up in the middle of these violent conflicts.
Well, you raise a whole host of issues there. And one that I think is important to emphasize, and I think especially for American audiences who maybe have different impressions of the Wehrmacht, is that, as you emphasize, the kind of improvised and shoestring nature of huge sections of the German war effort, not just occupation, but, you know, you could kind of go on and on, but how under-resourced the Germans were really in all kinds of important areas, and that they carry on and with these kind of projects anyway is a sign of their, I don't know what it's a sign of, but it makes their defeat seem hardly surprising in some ways.
I think in a nutshell, you could argue that whilst the German army, for taking the German army specifically as opposed to the Navy and the Air Force, was extremely proficient in many ways, in other ways it wasn't, and its overall strategy was too ambitious, far too ambitious, and it wasn't matched by the resources that it had at its disposal.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned one of the early factors that you mentioned as contributing to the violence in Yugoslavia is this the German army's penchant or desire for perfect order. And this is an issue that other scholars, Isabel Hull and so forth, have shown us in other contexts, but how that sort of poisoned the well for the Germans as they went in, expecting it to be able to control it so tightly.
Yes. Yeah, well, I think what you had there was a desire for perfect order, but not backed up with the resources in order to ensure it.
Right. And that contributes then to the desperation of the troops that we find on the ground.
Yes. I mean, one has to differentiate between, are you talking about ordinary troops, are you talking about their commanders? Certainly ordinary troops on the ground in many parts of Yugoslavia at many times during the war felt a great deal of desperation, a great deal of mortal fear.
Well, one of the things I like about the book is, you know, the clear exposition of some of the background of the German army, sort of the development of that strategic doctrine, and then at the personal level, the experience of some of these commanders that you study in the First World War, their Austrian background. Tell us a little bit about how that shapes their behavior.
Well, I think it's important to stress that the book is talking about a relatively small number of generals. So the findings which it produces, I would argue, are interesting, cause for further consideration, certainly cause for further research. The pattern which seems to emerge among the officers in this study is that the origin of those officers who came from Austria, as opposed to those officers who came from Germany, did play a significant part in hardening their attitude towards the conduct of anti-partisan warfare. I would say that that relationship becomes it's seen clearly at the highest command level when you look at generals like Franz Boehmer, who in 1941 autumn 1941 was the plenipotentiary commanding general in Serbia, and you also see it among some divisional and regimental commanders. Those commanders who were of Austrian origin, not in every case, but in quite a number of cases, do appear to have behaved more harshly. And that can be put down to a number of possible factors. And I stress possible factors because it's rarely, if ever, the case that one of these generals would have left us with letters or diaries or memoirs saying words to the effect of, you know, these Serbs or these Southern Slavs can't be trusted, let's give them hell, etc. But certainly if one thinks about the relationship between Austria and particularly Serbia before and during the First World War, it becomes apparent just why officers who didn't necessarily serve in Serbia during the First World War, but were certainly aware of just how bad the blood was between Austria and Serbia during the First World War, could well have been affected by that knowledge, by that group mentality, in a way that would have gone on to affect how they behaved towards any kind of unrest in occupied Yugoslavia in World War II. You can take the fact that it was a Serb who assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which led to the outbreak of the war in the first place. The fact that Austrian armies were humiliated serially in the field by the Serbian army in the first few months of World War I, and the only way they were able to take Serbia over in 1915 was with German help. The fact that the Austrian troops going into Serbia, particularly in 1914, came up not just against regular soldiers, but also against against guerrilla bands who inflicted heavy casualties upon them, but in ways which conventional armies have always traditionally seen as furtive and devious and underhand. And then moving somewhat further on into the war, even after the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria had overrun Serbia, when the Serb army retreated the coast, it took large numbers of Austrian prisoners with it on what for many became a death march. And it's also worth remembering that it was the exiled Serb army, which then returned from exile in autumn 1918 and spearheaded the Allied offensive in the southern Balkans, which led to the collapse of Austria-Hungary's Balkan front, and then directly after that to Austria-Hungary's surrender at the beginning of November 1918. So lots of historical reasons, going back to the First World War, why there was a great deal of bad blood between Austrians and Serbs. And one can go further back than that also, considering the longer history of Austrian counterinsurgency, Austro-Hungarian counterinsurgency in the Balkans, so not just in Serbia, but also in Bosnia, actually from the late 1870s onward. And that's really just a selection, if you like, of the historical reasons why Austrian Wehrmacht offers Austrian army. I just ought to get the terminology clear here. When one is talking about the Wehrmacht, one is usually talking about the German armed forces collectively, the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, the Navy, and the Army. And it's probably helpful for the purpose of this interview to talk about the Wehrmacht as equating with the German Army, because it probably makes things a little easier for listeners to understand. So we're talking about Austrian Wehrmacht officers fighting in Yugoslavia in World War II, influenced for a whole host of historical reasons in a hardening direction, particularly towards the Serbs.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you've made perfectly clear why that distinction is important to make in the Serbian case between officers with an Austrian background and those with a German background. And, of course, they were separate armies prior to 1937, right?
March 38, right. You had the union between Germany and Austria.
Correct, right. Separate institutions, not just separate national histories, but separate institutional histories that go back, and that might be something that's worth exploring in other contexts. Is that difference between the Austrian component of the unified Wehrmacht and the German one? So then the other factor relating to World War I is the service on the Eastern Front versus service on the West. You found again, however tentatively you want to make the conclusions, you found some patterns there as well.
Yeah, I think this is, again, another respect in which the book doesn't necessarily draw decisive conclusions, but certainly I think raises interesting questions for future studies. And I'm not the first person to raise these questions, but I've applied them to this context. And it's obviously important to remember that every battlefront in the First World War was bound to have a hardening, indeed often brutalizing effect on the officers and men who fought there, whether you're talking about the Western Front, the Italian Front, the Balkan Front, or the Eastern Front. I think the interesting thing about the Eastern Front in World War I, though, is the diverse ways in which officers and men could be affected in a hardening way, whether it was because of the nature of the fighting there, or because of the fact that in the East you had ethnic groupings, whether Slavs, Eastern Jews, or what have you, which for a number of reasons were associated by either German soldiers or by German-speaking Austrian soldiers with negative backward images of the East, however unjustifiable. That may seem to our eyes now, that is how they saw it at the time. And I'd argue that combination of brutal fighting conditions, the ethnic composition of the regions over which the Eastern Front was fought, but also the extremely harsh environmental conditions, bearing in mind the depth of the Russian winter, for example, made for a brutalizing combination, not necessarily the most brutalizing combination experienced by officers and men in World War I, but certainly a brutalizing combination.
Hmm. Yeah, you cite Vejas Lelevicius's Warland on the Eastern Front, which I think is an important book that kind of pointed us in that direction several years ago, with the disclaimer that he's a friend of mine from grad school. So this plug, you might be a little suspicious of.
No, fine. It's a very good book.
Yeah. So I guess, one more element that we can emphasize about your book is that it's not simply a matter of the Germans going in with their racial ideology and raping and pillaging, that you provide some nuance by getting into that level of the command structure and showing how German policy, changes and one could say evolves, over the period of the occupation, even though it's ultimately unsuccessful. So what do you think, it's not simply a matter of personnel, but how would you trace that evolution of the German policies?
So you're talking about German policy or German security policy in occupied Yugoslavia generally, i.e. not practiced by individual divisions, or are you asking about individual divisions?
Well, here? I guess I was saying, I mean, your book does talk about individual as commanders and their backgrounds and how that influenced their general approach, but that German policy changes over the short time span of this occupation between relying on harsher measures or trying to be a little bit more conciliatory and win hearts and minds and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're looking for a brief overview of that, I think the first, first couple of months or so of the occupation were really quite lenient in relative terms. And when we're talking about German occupation of Yugoslavia, we are talking about, as I said, a fairly non-extensive presence across occupied Yugoslavia as a whole. In those first few months of the occupation, you had one German occupation division in the independent state of Croatia. That was the 718th Infantry Division. And then you had another three occupation divisions operating in Serbia. Serbia was... it was very much a puppet state. Officially, the independent state of Croatia was not a puppet state. It was an Axis satellite, which had a somewhat higher level of status. But Serbia was under the Asimovic regime, and then under General Nedic was very much a puppet state. And the German approach to that puppet state, because this Serbia really was, as I said, in the first 8 months of the occupation, was the theatre of operations for the great majority of German troops in occupied Yugoslavia. The first two or three months of that occupation, the Germans had quite a hands-off approach to the majority Serb population. They did not have a hands-off approach towards the Jewish population in Serbia. Right from the start, the Jewish population was persecuted, increasingly murderously so as time went on. And at that point needs stressing that this leniency towards the majority Serb population was always coupled with harshness and eventually genocidal harshness towards the Jews. But yeah, towards the majority Serb population, relatively lenient. A big change came with the advent of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, because obviously that meant that the Yugoslav Communist partisans could now start to operate against the Germans. That isn't to say that they hadn't laid down plans for operating against the Germans already. They had. But what this meant was that they now had the nod from Moscow to start resisting. But the main cause of increasingly massive anti-Axis unrest across occupied Yugoslavia in 1941 was not as a result of it being fomented by the partisans or indeed any other group. It was fomented largely because of the brutal persecution of Jews, Sinti and Roma, and particularly Serbs in the independent state of Croatia, which the Ustasha regime there was enacting. Brutal pogroms, which really, for the sheer bestial nature of them, have more in common with, for instance, the Rwandan genocide than with the clinical, albeit utterly ruthless, German Nazi genocide of the Jews. So this explosion of ethnic mayhem in the independent state of Croatia led to a great many ordinary Serbs realizing that their national survival, their ethnic survival, depended on them resisting somehow. And the communist partisans, but also the Serb Chetniks, who were right-wing, nationalist and royalist, both sought to cut a very long story short, both sought to capitalize, to if you like, ride the reins of the popular revolt against Axis rule that was now developing. It should be stressed that the partisans were riding this beast more proactively than the Chetniks were. The Czechs were more hesitant because they were terrified, particularly leader Mihailovic was terrified at the prospect of vicious German reprisals towards any resistance. But eventually they had to, temporarily come in with the partisans to somehow ride the reins of the revolt, to take some kind of control over it, to give it some kind of direction. And the scale of that revolt and the partisan and Chetnik involvement in it led to a massive escalation of German harshness. Reprisal policy was ratcheted up brutally. It even exceeded the guidelines that were issued from on high. Just give you one example. In September 1941, the German Armed Forces High Command issued a proclamation stipulating that 100 hostages should be shot for every German soldier killed by a partisan or by a guerrilla. But the Wehrmacht commander on the spot, General Boehmer, of Austrian extraction, went a step further. He explicitly targeted these shootings against Jews. So there was that added ideological dimension to the killing being brought in there. So an extremely vicious reprisal campaign enacted by the Germans in the autumn of 1941. And it was the German army at the forefront of this campaign at this stage, not the SS and police. That brutal campaign was only one of the factors which led to the collapse of the revolt that autumn. We can talk about the other factors later if you like, but just in terms of that that swing from leniency to harshness and back to relative leniency again, it can't be denied that the brutality of German reprisals was one of the reasons why the Serb national revolt collapsed. Then the action moved, or the main body of the action moved from Serbia to the independent state of Croatia. The Chetniks in Serbia lay dormant for the rest of the war. The partisans under Tito moved into the independent state of Croatia because of the mountainous regions contained there. And the mountainous terrain in the, I might have called it the NDH, which was a slip of the tongue. The NDH is the acronym for the independent state of Croatia as it is spoken in Serbo-Croat. Off the top of my head, because I'm not a Serbo-Croat speaker, I can't remember what exact words NDH stand for. But anyway, you then had from 1942-43 a growing partisan movement in the independent state of Croatia, a growing Bosnian Serb Chetnik movement in the independent state of Croatia, utterly antagonistic towards each other, all thoughts of alliance now gone. The Bosnian Muslims, to an extent, caught in the middle, but also involved in the inter-ethnic violence as well. Atrocities and counter-atrocities committed by all three of these groups against one another, although it's fair to say that the partisans learned sooner, a lot sooner than the Ustasha, to rein in their brutality as a means of appealing to all ethnic groupings in Yugoslavia, in occupied Yugoslavia, and thereby strengthening their numbers and their support. And over time, it became increasingly apparent that the partisans were, by a considerable weight, the most troublesome of these groups towards the occupation. This led to an influx of ever greater numbers of German troops, both Wehrmacht and SS, into the independent state of Croatia, and a growing number of extremely brutal, large-scale anti-partisan operations in the independent state of Croatia. What happened was, though, these brutal, large-scale anti-partisan operations were often interspersed with attempts at greater leniency. The difficulty was that the overriding dynamic was in a more brutal direction, so attempts at leniency to co-opt the population, to declare amnesties for partisan deserters, in some cases to arrange prisoner exchanges with the partisans didn't have the lasting effects that they could have done, because the brutal nature of the German anti-partisan operations were highly unlikely to win over popular support. I've talked about this at some length, but there's just one more point it's worth making at this stage, which is that it's worth asking why German brutality succeeded in Serbia in 1941, but not in the independent state of Croatia in 1942-43. The reasons for that are complex, but one of the reasons, it's fair to say, is that by now they were facing increasingly large numbers of partisans, and the terror tactics which they had employed against the population in Serbia were actually harder to enact in a more systematic way in the independent state of Croatia because of the terrain, because of the fact that large areas were falling fully under partisan control, and also because the Germans just didn't have enough troops on the ground in order to back up the reprisals that they were carrying out with genuine decisive military blows against the partisans. So it's one thing to try and terrorize the population into submission, but when it's increasingly difficult to combine that terroristic campaign with general military blows against the partisans, then terror starts to have less of a decisive long-term effect. And there are other reasons why the brutal German tactics in the independent state of Croatia weren't working, which I won't go into now because I think it would probably take too long to answer. But that's a sketch of some of the reasons anyway.
Well, I had several, took notes about several issues I wanted to raise, but one thing that just occurred to me from your final comments is how, and I don't recall from the book, is how important was external support of the partisans or the Chetniks in enabling them or, you know, to defeat the Germans or to frustrate the Germans, at least?
Well, the book Terror in the Balkans doesn't cover the entire course of the insurgency stroke counterinsurgency in Yugoslavia. It stops in spring 1943. Now, prior to then, it is probably fair to say that external support, i.e. from the British, the Americans, the Soviets, didn't have a particularly decisive effect. Things did change in 1943. The British and Americans transferred such support as they'd been giving to the Chetniks to the partisans when they realized that out of all the groups in occupied Yugoslavia, only the partisans could be said to be actively working against the Axis occupation. The Chetniks were either in a dormant state or in some cases were collaborating with the Axis against the partisans. The support which the Allies were able to provide, we're talking predominantly about Western Allied support rather than Soviet support, because as the Allies, the Western Allies encroached upon the Mediterranean front of occupied Europe, they were able to provide more practical help to the partisans. And that help started to manifest itself in other ways as the war in the Mediterranean turned against the Axis. So it became increasingly possible for the Allies to support the partisans from the air and from the sea, especially as the Allies advanced up the Italian peninsula from autumn 1943 onward. And developments of the Italian peninsula had a massive effect also. Italy's collapse in September 1943 led to huge amounts of equipment and arms and indeed some Italian personnel going over to the partisans. They were able to seize huge amounts of equipment and weaponry to their great advantage, and they were able to do this more effectively, much more effectively than the Chetniks were. So outside support had an increasingly important effect as time went by, but up until spring 43, the period that my book looks at, it wasn't a major factor.
Well, that discussion of the various parties involved also reminds me of a point that you raised earlier about the Germans being entangled in these local disputes, and it happens elsewhere other than Yugoslavia too. I just read Holly Case's book on Transylvania, right? So the rivalry between the Romanians and the Hungarians that sort of drags the Germans unwillingly in that case, I think, into that that political territorial tangle, and it happens in Yugoslavia with much more direct, military consequences. But that's an interesting phenomenon about German expansion. The other thing that struck me in the book, and that I remember encountering in the archive too, is this penchant for euphemism, right? Or I don't, maybe that's not the right description of it, but you give us countless examples of the Germans, engaged in anti-partisan operations, and they kill 100 partisans and seize 3 pistols, right? That's maybe an exaggeration, but
no, it's not. in a lot of cases, it's not. Yeah,
they call it bandit. We rounded up 250 bandits, including women and children, and confiscated 15 rifles or something like that. And the reliance on these terminologies like bandits and partisans when the targets are clearly civilians, or in many cases Jews, if you look at the Eastern Front. And I even remember seeing it on documents that are clearly secret, right? So it's not like this is a press release. This is communication between people who clearly know what's up, but they rely on these euphemisms.
Yes.
I don't know what to make of that. But
No. It's, I think... If you take the example of bandits, it's debatable as to whether they themselves, that is to say the German commanders, actually saw it as a euphemism so much as an accurate description of the opponent they were facing. One of the things that's interesting about the use of the word bandit is that Heinrich Himmler in, I think, May 1942, I could be wrong, but I think May 1942, made it compulsory terminology to be used in reports on anti-partisan warfare. They were to be referred to as bandits. But there are cases which I refer to in Terror in the Balkans of German army Wehrmacht commanders using such terminology earlier than Himmler did, in the first few weeks of the campaign. And you could argue that is a legacy of the German military's long-standing aversion to irregular warfare, an aversion which many historical cases suggest was stronger in the German military than it was in the militaries of other governments. I think that is it needs to be a qualified view, because there are cases of German counterinsurgency campaigns prior to World War II, for instance in the Ukraine in 1918, which weren't all about brutality. They weren't all about terror. They employed leniency to an extent as well. One doesn't want to get into the differences in the various counterinsurgency campaigns that the German military pursued before World War II, but it is important to recognize that it wasn't all brutal. Certainly what can be claimed, though, is that a lot of it was brutal, and it was that brutal tradition that was invoked, not these more moderate traditions that were invoked by the commanders on the spot in Yugoslavia, certainly 1941 and to a very great extent in 42 and 43 as well. So whether they saw the term bandit as euphemistic or accurate, I think is an important point to bear in mind, important issue to bear in mind anyway.
And it, even though the documentary evidence isn't as clear, as you said before, as you might wish for, that kind of the logical step about the kind of historical prejudices and stereotypes that had developed about the nature of the Balkans and so forth, probably plays a role in that.
Yeah. Again, though, I think I would stress that it's important not to get too teleological about this. It's important to recognize, I think, for instance, that within the Austrian military, the Austro-Hungarian military, prior to 1918, there was a tradition of ethnic toleration as well. There were moderating influences at work. It would be wrong. I mean, I know you're not doing this, but I think it'd be wrong for anyone reading this book to conclude that, in the Balkan context, German equals lenient, Austrian equals harsh. It's not as simple as that. Many German commanders were brutal for various reasons, and there were historical reasons why Austrian commanders had a tradition of moderation on which they could draw, as well as a tradition of harshness. What I'm saying is that whether it was for reasons as perceived necessity from 1941 onward, or for reasons to do with the particular commanders of Austrian origin who were operating on the spot in Yugoslavia during World War II, harshness was relied upon more than moderation, and it was harsh traditions, those harsh historical traditions, that were drawn upon rather than the more moderating ones.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Austrian occupation of Serbia in the First World War was has actually been characterized as relatively lenient in terms of extractions of food and so forth, while Vienna was really facing hard times.
Yeah.
If I recall, there was an official policy not to simply plunder Serbia for the benefit of Vienna. So there are countervailing historical precedents as well.
Yes, I would say that. I mean, having said that, it depends what you're talking about relative to. The Austrians were not as brutal and exploitative in Serbia, in occupied Serbia in World War I, as the Bulgarians were. Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria being allied to Germany in World War I, the Austro-Hungarians and the Bulgarians carved occupied Serbia between them. The Bulgarians were a good deal worse, or significantly worse. There are conflicting views on this. I would say that a really good work on the Austro-Hungarian occupation of Serbia in World War I is by Jonathan Gums, which I think came out in 2008, and it's called The Resurrection and Collapse of Empire in Habsburg Serbia. He certainly argues that this occupation was not a blueprint for brutal Nazi occupation in World War II. It needs to be seen more as a 19th century style of occupation rather than a blueprint for a more brutal 20th century fascist occupation.
I guess it's the sad truth when we're talking about these kinds of subjects is that we're often talking about relative levels of atrocity and depravity.
Yeah.
So
yes.
On that happy note.
Yes,
well,
very happy.
I think we've touched on the major issues that your book raises, and I think it does a great job of clarifying, at least as you said, for that limited sample and that and even that limited time period in the Balkans, and sort of some of the factors that shaped German occupation in that area. And I think people will naturally try to extend that research to other areas and test some of these hypotheses.
Yeah.
Look forward to that.
I hope so.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you're working on now? And then, as I said, I warned you I'd ask you about what you're reading, but maybe you want to sidestep that question, what new books you read. But
Well, I actually thought about the new books I've read, and I realize I have actually read rather a lot of interesting new books in the last few months. When I was initially asked by you to reflect on the new works that I have read, I've read fewer new works in the last few months than in previous periods, partly because the book I am now working on is going to be a general history of the German army under the Third Reich, particularly during World War II. And I'm currently working through the standard works, particularly the standard works on the operational performance of the German army in World War II. My previous monographs, War in the Wild East and Terror in the Balkans, given that they have preoccupied themselves with the role of the army in occupation, the role of the army in the Nazi state, its relationship with National Socialism, its role in atrocities in not just anti-partisan warfare, but also in other spheres of occupation, mean that I'm a relative newcomer to developing expertise in the operational side of the German army in World War II. So I'm currently ploughing through the standard works on the operational history of the German army. And the book that will result, I'm very much hoping, is going to be, I wouldn't say a groundbreaking, monumental new work, but what it will be is a new kind of synthesis of The major research that's been done on the German army, whether in terms of its combat performance, its role in the occupation, its relationship with the Nazi state, its position and its relationship with German society, what this book that I'm writing is going to do is going to synthesize and I very much hope come up with some fresh new interpretations of the massive body of scholarship which has been produced on the topic of the German army under the Third Reich over the last 30 years. The last English language overviews of the German army came out really in the late 70s, early 80s, with works like Albert Seaton, The German Army 1933-45. Excellent works, but published before this mushrooming of scholarship on the German army, particularly its role in the much darker aspects of World War II, occupation, genocide, and so on. You've got a massive mushrooming of works in this area from the 1980s onward. And then with the opening of former Eastern Bloc archives, you've got a mushrooming of new interest in really all aspects of the German army in the Second World War as it related to Eastern Europe, whether that's to do with the occupation, with issues of genocide, war crimes, or the actual fighting at the front. So a huge volume of scholarship that's emerged in the last 30 years for these and other reasons, which I'm looking to synthesize and convey in a scholarly but engaging and accessible way for a general readership. The idea is for it to be done, it's being published with Yale, and the idea is for it to be published to coincide with the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in 2015.
Well, good luck with that. I suspect you know the work, but one of my recent interviews was with David Stahl. Who is published in with Cambridge University Press. This mm-hmm. was in 2009, the Operation Barbarossa. I found that a very helpful book, and I guess he followed that up. By the time I'd interviewed him, he was already coming out with a book on Kiev. So that kind of operational operational history. There's plenty of that to read.
Absolutely. I mean, I think particularly with respect to the Eastern Front, although not exclusively, the sheer volume of quality scholarship which has been emerging in recent years, as exemplified by Stahl and others, is prolific. So there's a lot to immerse myself in. It's a challenge, but an interesting one.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. It was a fascinating interview. I hope the listeners to New Books in Military History will take the time to explore not only this book but the one that's forthcoming. I think that'd be right up. Maybe we'll have you back again sometime.
That'd be great. Thanks. I shall look forward to that.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jay.
You've been listening to my interview with Ben Shepherd, author of Terror in the Balkans, German Armies and Partisan Warfare, which appeared with Harvard University Press in 2012. Thanks for listening.